From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in Atlanta, Georgia on July 14, 1990, when police found the bodies of a 23-year-old woman and her daughter in their apartment. Julie Kim and her daughter Jackie Dafcorn were fatally shot by Kim's estranged partner. For nearly 30 years, their friends and family have been grieving their loss, some through quiet processing, some through public activism for responsible gun ownership. Charon Sattler LeBlanc is one of those activists. Julie Kim was her cousin. Sattler LeBlanc is now the local chapter leader for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, and while she promotes responsible gun ownership, she has applied for a concealed carry permit, she herself does not own a gun. Her colleague at Moms Demand Action, Toni Nelson, lost her partner and her child to gun violence. She's an active member in several gun violence survivor groups, but unlike Sattler LeBlanc, she has a permit and carries a firearm. Both women say the tragic losses in their lives have informed their perspectives on gun ownership. We've invited them on the program today to share their stories and discuss how they formed their decisions about gun ownership. It's part of a larger conversation about gun laws in New York. We'll discuss concealed carry laws, new gun storage laws, a ban on 3D printing, and more. 3D printing of guns. This is a conversation we planned a few weeks in advance, one that was in the works before the mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton this past weekend. Those events will come up during our discussion this hour, but it's largely a conversation about questions of the law and personal decision-making. We have a lot to cover this hour, and I'd like to thank all my guests for being here. Joining me in studio, Charon Sattler LeBlanc. She's a volunteer for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
Toni Nelson is also a volunteer for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense and the founder of the M Squared Foundation for Peace and Social Change. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about M Squared.
M Squared is an idea I came up with. My husband was murdered in Rochester in 1993 after he came home from Desert Storm. He was in the Marines. And then in 2014, our son, Michael, was murdered in Rochester. And at that point, it just was too much to bear. So M Squared is named for both of them, my husband and my son, Foundation for Peace and Social Change, where we want to work with young people from ages of 5 to 10. We want to teach them life skills and conflict resolution and meditation so that they know how to navigate through conflicts without conflicts.
I'm so sorry for your losses.
Thank you.
Charon, I'm so sorry for your losses as well. Toni, where can we learn more about M Squared?
Well, you can learn more. Our website is being developed right now. Right now, you can reach out to me msquaredfoundation@gmail.com. And the website is going to be msquarefoundation.org. And you can give me a call at any time at 585-857-6928. And I'll be happy to talk to anybody about what's going on with us and the things we have in store for the young people in our city.
We'll post all that information on our website, listeners, if you want to check that out. Also joining me in studio, Sarah Dumries. She's a volunteer for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense as well. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Corey Brown is the Monroe County Undersheriff. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
We have a lot to talk about this hour, as I mentioned, but I'd like to get to the events of this past weekend now because, as I mentioned, today's conversation was not driven by what happened in El Paso and Dayton, but I know some listeners probably can't help but wonder how they have affected our guests. An El Paso investigators say a 21-year-old man killed 22 people at a Walmart store. They say the suspect used an AK-47 military-style rifle in the attack. The FBI is investigating the shooting as an act of domestic terrorism and a possible hate crime because prior to the shooting, that suspect posted a white supremacist anti-immigrant manifesto online. In Dayton, police are unsure of what motivated the 24-year-old suspect who used a high-capacity rifle with 100-round drum magazines to kill 9 people, including his sister, and that was outside a popular nightclub in a nightlife district. So, Charon, I'll start with you. Have your personal views about gun ownership changed in light of the mass shootings this weekend?
No. I'll just share that actually Sarah and I just returned from a conference in Washington, D.C., and so we were actually in a plenary. We actually had all of our volunteers, almost 2,000 volunteers, in a basically we were all at lunch and listening to speakers when we were informed of the shooting at El Paso. And so, of course, there was a hush that came over the room, and people were moving quickly to kind of figure out how we were going to respond. And I think one of the most powerful moments probably of the entire weekend was when a student from Students Demand Action from the Baltimore chapter took the podium and the mic and said, you know, here we are, and all of our work around diversity and equity and inclusion and challenging media, and where is the outrage for the three people in Baltimore who died this weekend? And I think, you know, the mass shootings certainly bring great attention to the issues of gun violence in our country, but it highlights a much deeper problem. Every day in our country, over 300 Americans will be shot, and about 100 of them will die from their injuries. And gun violence really hits a cross-section of all of us. I mean, we're all, we can all be victims of gun violence, whether it's by, unfortunately, the mass shootings we've seen, but in our communities and our homes. And I think that's what's really important, is that we keep talking about what can we do and what can be the ways that we can reduce the risk and keep more of our loved ones safe.
And you do not own a gun.
I do not.
You are applying for, or you have applied for, a concealed carry permit.
I have been approved.
You have been approved.
I have been approved. I am still waiting from the, I believe it's the county clerk's office, who's up next to get me my permit.
As she looks over at the sheriff.
Adam Bellow, get me my permit.
So even though that has been approved, you do not want a firearm in your house. And tell me a little bit why you've made that choice.
Well, I've actually lived in houses where we have had firearms. And so I've seen, and when I was growing up, there was an incident in a relative's home that my father thought it was necessary to bring rifles into the house. And so for a number of years, those rifles were kept in the bedroom, my parents' bedroom, leaned up between two dressers with all of the ammunition in the top drawer right next to them. And that's where they pretty much stood for the most part. And with the work that I've done with volunteering for Moms Demand Action, I've done a lot of reading about it. And I personally do not feel that it's going to bring me any additional safety. So that's been a decision on my part. As a matter of fact, in my 20s, while I was visiting my parents, I was no longer living with them. My father and my mother got into an argument. He was in his 70s at that time. He locked himself into the bedroom and was threatening to kill himself. And my mom was telling me to go back and talk to him. And I'm like, oh no, I'm not going to do that. So I called 911. And so fortunately, it's a small rural town in Illinois. And so we lived just down the street from the chief of police. And, you know, we had those conversations. And I said that, you know, if you want me to come and visit and not leave, we need these to go. If you are going to threaten to hurt yourself and terrorize your family, that I'm not going to put up with this. And so we were able to get those firearms removed. And I'll be honest, on his deathbed, my father said that I did not make the right decision. And I said to him, nope, you should never have put me in that position. And that's the, you know, I feel very strongly about that even today.
Mm-hmm. Tony, I know you have a very different view about gun ownership, and we'll talk about what has informed your views. But first, how have you been affected by the events of this past weekend?
Oh, wow. I just confusion. I don't understand the rage and the hatred. I don't understand the anger, which tends to be the scenario in most of these shootings. And it takes me back, because I know, you know, there's a parent without a child, there's a child without a parent, and it just takes me back to my own situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Under Sheriff Brown, before we hear the personal stories that Tony and Sharon have been so willing to share with us, which we appreciate, I know our listeners appreciate, I'd like to talk to you about a couple new gun laws in New York. So last week, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the Safe Storage Bill into law that expands the state's existing lockup rules so as to make it more difficult for children to get access to guns that are in a home. Beginning September 28th, gun owners living with a child could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor if they don't use a gun locking device or lock their guns in a cabinet or safe when the firearms are not in their immediate possession. That's the Safe Storage Bill. Also last week, Governor Cuomo signed a measure banning the manufacturing, sale, and possession of firearms that are not detected by metal detectors, and that's meant to ban 3D printed guns. So how much of that is on your radar under Sheriff Brown, and what impact do you think those laws will have in Monroe County?
So the safe storage law, just so everyone's aware, there was a law existing that you mentioned. It was for anyone that if you live with somebody that was disqualified from having a firearm, whether federally or state, because of something else, then you were required to make sure that your gun was locked up. when it's not in your possession. So I think it's rendered unusable is the language. So now it includes if you live with a 16-year-old or younger, or they come over your house, you have to make sure that your gun is locked up and that they don't have access to it. And I don't know how impactful that's going to be as far as proactive. Unfortunately, I think the only way we really find out about that is after something happens or if somebody reports them. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. I think the best part about that now can be education. Education to make sure that, you know, if you have kids over your house, that which is much more numerous, I guess, right? A lot of people have kids than somebody that has lives with somebody that's illegal for them to possess. So it becomes more, it's going to be more opportunity for, to educate the public about this is really how they have to store their guns, and you want to make sure that they don't have access to them, and this is how you can store it safely. So I think storing a gun safely around children is a good idea. So I think overall it's a good thing. Enforcement of it could be tricky because, you know, you're not in everyone's house, and people don't want the police in their house, and I understand that. So I really think that we just need to try to educate people. I know we do a gun safety course and a home safety course for guns that I recommend everyone takes. And this will obviously be part of that, about how you can safely store your weapon so that no one else can use it accidentally.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the education component locally? Are we doing enough in Monroe County and Rochester to educate people? I assume these classes or workshops are voluntary. Do you feel like, you know, the right questions are being asked among the community? How should this change if you don't?
So in my personal opinion, and not speaking as a sheriff, but in my personal opinion, I would think it'd be a good thing if we could make sure that everyone that owns a gun trains with a gun, goes to a safety course. I'm sure Tony has gone to safety courses and make sure she knows what she's doing and that the gun is safely locked up. So she's shaking her head no. So
oh,
I would,
you haven't? Okay.
I have not gone to a safety course.
Okay.
I have received a free lock. Thank you. Thanks to Ernest Flagler. But no, I haven't yet.
So I think that's a thing right there. I think the key, and when anyone asks me about should I get a gun or whatever, I say it depends. Are you going to train with it? Are you going to know how to use it? Are you going to know what you're doing? Do you know how to store it? Do you know where to keep it? And all those options are out there. So obviously, just by that answer, we need to do a better job. Mm-hmm. And we need to make those more available to people. But I think when people get a permit, they should realize that they need to take these courses. And here's how you do that. And we're just not there. And so I think we need to do a better job of doing that. How we do that, I'm not sure. But I always believe in, you know, it's the sheriff, and I always talk about for our deputies, training, 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 mm-hmm. right? We always want to train more. Well, if you own a gun, you're responsible for that gun. You should train with it. You should be comfortable using it. It shouldn't be something that you don't know how to use or that the first time you go to use it is when you need it or you think you need it because you haven't trained on it. So I think there's a lot of training opportunities that are out there that we could do a better job with.
Are you seeing a lot of 3D printed guns in the county? I know that, you know, the ban is a new law. I haven't heard much about it locally. Is that something that
I have not heard a lot about 3D printed guns. I could see anytime you have a gun that can get through a metal detector is a problem, right? Nationally, everywhere. I mean, we go through, just think about it, going on a plane next week. I would hate for somebody to bring a 3D printed gun through the metal detector. So I could see where that's valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll also be discussing concealed carry laws with Under Sheriff Brown and Sarah Dumrice this hour. But first, I do want to talk to Chiron and Tony about their experiences with gun violence and loss. And again, I'm so sorry for the losses in your family.
Thank you.
You're doing important work in the community. You're representing many voices that we will never, unfortunately, have time to hear on this program. So it's important that you're sharing your stories, and we appreciate that. And I'll start with you, Chiron. You sent me some information in advance, and we've talked about this a little on the show already, about what happened in your family. But before we talk about any incidents, what was Julie like as a person?
Well, Julie was a few years older than me, you know. So she was the one who was able to find the cool clothes and know all the right kids, and she had a stereo before the rest of us. So her younger sister and I were very close in age, so we just really looked up to her. And she had this effervescent laugh that would just kind of crack a little bit. So again, she was just someone we always aspired to, and there was always this kind of joy and love when we were all together. And it's, you know, that's something you take for granted, but that was family.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's been a long time since we've been able to have that.
Tell us about her daughter, Jackie.
So it's interesting because Julie actually was born in Korea. And so most of my family has connections to Korea. You know, most of them came from Korea. And Jackie, like me, her father is white. And so I grew up, I started going to school in the early 70s, so I felt very awkward and very different. And it was also right after the Vietnam War, so I was kind of reminded, because kids are not always nice. But I was reminded I was a little different. And Jackie just was very confident. I just remember we used to, you know, say like, oh, Jackie, you're so beautiful. And she would just kind of flip her silky long hair and say, I know. So she was just kind of the gem for all of us and just kind of brought us all together. So,
mm-hmm. When you heard about what happened, and I'll let you share as much as mm-hmm. is comfortable for you, how old were you?
So I was going into my senior year of college. I remember it was a dorm room in Chicago, DePaul University, when I got the call from my cousin Kathy, and I don't actually remember much of the phone call, but I remember my friend came over, and I just remember pacing and talking and just feeling very surreal, and she kind of let me rant for a long time, and then she said, we're going to pack you a bag, and you're going to come home with me, and you're going to spend the night with us, and so I was really grateful for that. I remember driving down to Atlanta with my family, and I also remember, you know, everything just seemed very surreal from, you know, asking for time off from my supervisor because I felt like I was lying. I mean, who does this happen to? Like, what do you say? You know, this was 1990. And I also remember getting to the memorial service. It was a memorial service because we did not find their bodies for several days, and their bodies were such that they couldn't even tell how many times they'd been shot. Mm. So there were no bodies. And so just kind of the reality just hit, and I just remember going into the bathroom and doubling over and, you know, being taken over by sobs. And it was, just, you know, you don't know how to respond to it because this is stuff you might see in a TV show. This is not something that should be happening to your family.
Mm-hmm. How did your family come together to deal with this, work through it, support each other?
We've gone through a lot of challenges. My family that was directly impacted is in Atlanta, Georgia, and my surviving cousin, was very active in an evangelical church. And so that was very difficult because we were told that Jackie was in heaven because she's an innocent child. But if you do the math, Julie was 23 years of age, so she was a teen mom when she became a parent. And she was finally able to make enough money to support her daughter and get her own apartment, which is why Steve knew she was never going to come back. And she was dancing. So because she was not married, because she hadn't had a full immersion baptism and all the other reasons, if you want to list them, she was not in heaven. So some very challenging things there, and so some challenges with my cousin. And then my surviving cousin, right now today, she's incarcerated in Georgia because she has a mental illness, which I'm sure she would have been mentally ill anyway. But having to deal with the trauma of all of this was probably pushed it to another level. My aunt is about to be put into an assisted living. She has survived several strokes, and she has had to really occupy herself with caring for her mentally ill daughter. So it's been devastating. Last summer when I went to Atlanta for our conference, my family is buried there. All three of them are actually buried together. And when I talked to some of her, you know, the people who were helping her, they thought that her family had died in a car accident. So there's so much shame because I think in part, you know, so many of us are from Korea and we just don't talk about these things. One of the phrases I heard was that, so embarrassing, don't talk about it, don't tell anyone. Fortunately, my mom doesn't listen to this radio program, so she won't know, but I'm not sure she'd be really happy about it. And I think that just highlights just the shame that comes along with this. You know, and the other piece of it too is there's another family who isn't in a position to talk about it, and that's Steve's family. And I've connected with his sister, and you know, I don't know what their grief is, but it's a different kind of grief and shame that they deal with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm there's nothing to say mm-hmm. in a situation like this, and I know that everyone handles grief in a different way, and it sounds like your family has had so much to grapple with over the years, and you've taken a very different approach. You're out in the community, you're an activist, you are very vocal, and I'm sure that's maybe caused some conversations in your family where people aren't perhaps comfortable with you being an activist, but you know, what brought you to this place where you've decided, you know, I know this is not what my family would do, but this is what I need to do?
It's interesting because for a long time, like in the first couple of years after it all happened, like trying to understand what contributed to all of this, you know, maybe it's because Steve didn't have someone to really talk to and if someone had really listened to him. But over the years, it was an easy access. He was able to walk into a Walmart and purchase a firearm, a Glock. He'd never owned a gun before. He didn't know how to handle them. He bought it for the one purpose. And I think it made it incredibly easy for him to do that. Horrific, but easy and fast. And for all the difficulty they were going through at that time, it stole him of the time to work through his, you know, obviously he was upset with the breakup. You know, I know many of us have survived breakups. It can be very difficult and very painful, but many of us can work through them just fine. But what we need is time. And that's what we didn't get. So it's interesting over the years, like, you know, there was Columbine and then there was, you know, certainly after Sandy Hook. Over the years, I've engaged in what they call rage giving. So, you know, things happen, you get angry, you wonder why you're in your office doubled over and sobbing, and then you start putting it all together. And it was actually after the Charleston, South Carolina shooting at Mother Emanuel. And I said, you know, we didn't do anything after they slaughtered two classrooms of children. Who's going to care about a prayer group at a black church? And I think that must have been Every Town for Gun Safety. And sort of the model that's much different about Moms Demand Action is in a couple of weeks, someone called me and thanked me. So that, I think, has been the power of that organization, is really the grassroots nature of it and connecting volunteers to each other.
Mm-hmm. I know you're looking into some actual training in handling mm-hmm. a firearm, which we touched on before. I have a question for a listener that we can address in a moment. But, you know, for someone who doesn't want to have a gun in the home, and has been through what you've been through, why do you want the experience of learning how to use the gun, or a gun?
To be effective in this work, we have to be able to connect across a lot of different communities. And I think there's so many organizations, and I think there's organizations right here in New York who are very afraid of the work that we're doing. But I think we all have very common goals. We want to keep our families safe. We recognize that there's strength in community. We want to make sure that we're passing good, enforceable laws that people understand. I think there's so much common ground. And I honestly, even that we want people to have good training and know what they're doing. We want the right people, if they're going to own firearms, not to be dangerous, not to be criminals, not to threaten or hurt their neighbors and families. We agree on all those things. And for me, one, it's, I want to know, I know we have really good, strong gun laws in New York State. So part of it was just, I want to see and know what it's like, because I've heard some things about what it's like to get a permit, and, you know, so I wanted to see how it actually works.
Mm-hmm. There's a question from a listener who says there are counties, Saratoga County, for instance, that require mandatory training by the sheriff's office to qualify to obtain a pistol permit. Would the Monroe County Sheriff be willing to follow that example? Saratoga requires both classroom and practical qualifications. Under Sheriff Brown, I know you're not speaking for the sheriff specifically, but how do you feel about that question?
So as I mentioned before, I think it would be wonderful if there was some kind of training that you had to do before you got a firearm, and how we would help facilitate that, or I'm not sure. I mean, but we could certainly, I would love to explore that opportunity for the sheriff's office and for the local gun community, because I think responsible gun owners want people to train. They don't want people that are going to buy a gun and just never use it, right? They want people to train with it and know what they're doing. So I think that'd be a wonderful option.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sharon, before we move on to hear Tony's story, one last question for you about the safe storage bill, the new law passed by Governor Cuomo recently. You're a step-parent to two sons who are on the autism spectrum. Do you feel like the safe storage bill, as Sheriff Brown described it, is enough? Would you, not that you are bringing a gun into your home, but if you lived with someone who did, do you feel like that bill covers the concerns that you might have?
Legislation is part of it, and I think laws can help shape culture and behavior. For example, I think most of us feel pretty naked if we get into a car and don't put our seatbelt on. It's not that there's an officer outside of our vehicle when we step into our cars every day, and a lot of times it might be a 4-year-old in the back seat who's yelling at you to put your seatbelt on. But laws can help shape culture and change behavior. So I'm encouraged that we have some good laws in the state of New York that will encourage some, I think, shift culture and encourage folks to think about having, you know, robust storage for their firearms. So it's, nothing is going to be perfect. Nothing is going to solve everything. But legislation is an important tool to help shape our society.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Sure.
Listeners, we'll take our only break of the hour. When we come back, we'll hear Toni Nelson's story and hear more about her work in the community and her views on gun ownership. We'll also talk about concealed carry laws. We'll hear about the efforts that Sarah Dumreis is making. And to describe it briefly, Sarah, she's working to try to encourage a local grocery chain to change their policy. I don't know if that word is appropriate, but to change their views on concealed carry in their store. So we'll talk about all that after our break. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. And you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. Short break, more connections next. Coming up in our second hour, what does it mean to be acting human? The concept refers to a mindful way of living, in the moment, writing one's own story. Musician, director, former professor Richard Dubin has written an ebook on the subject, and he's collaborating with other creative people across the country on projects designed around this way of thinking. We'll talk to him about what it means, how to do it, and how art and life intersect. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about gun ownership in New York State, the laws, including new laws that the state has passed, and also some personal stories when it comes to gun violence, tragedies, and how those experiences have informed personal decisions about owning guns. My guests this hour are Charon Sattler LeBlanc, a volunteer for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense; Toni Nelson, also a volunteer for Moms Demand Action, and she's the founder of the M Squared Foundation for Peace and Social Change; Sarah Dumreis is in studio, she's a volunteer for Moms Demand Action; and Undersheriff Corey Brown is also in our studio with us. I'll turn to Toni Nelson now, who, like Charon, has a personal story related to gun violence. Toni, you lost your husband and your son to gun violence in separate incidents. Again, I'm so sorry for your loss. You're here today to talk about their legacy, the important work that you are doing in the community. And I'll start by asking you, what were they like? Tell our listeners what they were like as people.
You know, it's funny. My husband, I call him Mike, and because we had to differentiate. So when Michael was born, Mike had to be Mike, not Michael. My mom said so. So they were so much alike, considering the fact that Mike was killed when Michael was 4. So he didn't really know his dad, but they were the goofiest, you know, they just made you laugh. You know, they were silly and fun. You know, they always lifted me up, both of them, you know. Mike was my high school sweetheart. We got married right out of high school. He went into the Marine Corps. My son was born in Camp Lejeune down in North Carolina. And then, you know, I moved back home. So shortly after Mike came back from Desert Storm, he was murdered on the corner of Bay and 7th in Rochester in what they call mistaken identity, which I don't know what that's about. Like, if you're going to shoot somebody, you should know who you're shooting. Not that you should shoot somebody, but at least know who the heck you're shooting. He was 24, almost 25, and he was getting ready to go back into the reserves, the Marine Corps reserves. So it was a loss. It was a big loss. I was so young, being 23. I don't really think I processed it because I had a son to raise. You know what I mean? So all my energy and effort went into that. Fast forward 2014, and my son, who was also 24, almost 25, when he was murdered in a what they call wrong place, wrong time, which I certainly don't understand that one. If you're somewhere and not bothering anybody, in actuality, my son was sleeping when he was murdered. Mm. When that happened, I got pissed. You took away my baby. Like, I carried this child, I nurtured this child, I raised this child, and for absolutely no reason that I would understand, he's gone. And it brought a lot of things to the forefront. You see the news, you see what goes on in the news, but you don't feel it. And when your child is taken, you feel it. You feel a lot of emotions. You feel a lot of emotions. So I had to do something. I didn't know what. It took a little while. I went through a bout of depression. I'm still in therapy for it. I recommend therapy if it's for you. But we decided, and when I say we, there's a group of people that have supported me so much. We decided to start M Squared, Foundation for Peace and Social Change, because we want to change the mindset of young people growing up. When you respect and love yourself, you'll respect and love others. And when your life is valuable, you'll value other people's lives. And that's what we want to get across to young people. We want to work with them and their families, because if you work with young people and you don't change the mindset of the people in their homes, it kind of doesn't work. But I'm really passionate about it. I met Charan, and I just love her and the work she does. I also work with a group called Rise Up Rochester. They have a support group for people who have lost someone. And Michael, they call him Big Mike, which I don't call him Big Mike because his dad was Big Mike, but they don't know that. They call him Big Mike. He was 6'3". He was like 300 pounds. He's a big guy. But he was like the big teddy bear of the neighborhood. And I mean, literally in a 12 block radius, everybody knew him. He would pull people's garbage cans to the front yard when it was garbage day. He would take my lawnmower and cut everybody's grass, and then I'd wonder why I didn't have any gas, you know, in my lawnmower. And all the, when he passed away, a lot of the ladies in the street said, "He always cut my grass." I'm like, "I know. That's why my mowers were always broke." And, you know, it's like, I'm like, "Well, what happened? I only do my grass like every other week." But he was a big help in the neighborhood businesses. He would go up and help out in the businesses for a couple dollars, you know, just pocket change and just help out people. And that's how people knew him, by his beautiful infectious smile and just being that guy in the neighborhood. They know if they were moving something or needed help with something, they could call Big Mike. And I'm finding that I don't have a lot of street cred, but when I say I'm Big Mike's mom, mm-hmm. Okay, no problem. You know, we can help out. I'm like, really? That, it just amazed me, the amount of people at his funeral. Like, I don't even know that many people. And people that I've met at, you know, when Sam's Club was here, there was a cashier and he favored my son, and me and my daughter were whispering. He's like, "Oh, you're talking about Big Mike?" And I'm like, "You know my son?" "Well, no, but they talk about him at Job Corps." "Really?" You know, so it's just amazing to me, the people that he touched. He touched so many people in 24 short years. And I just, I am intent on keeping his legacy alive. You know, he deserves that. Mm-hmm. And he didn't get to finish it out, so Mom's going to do that. As long as I have a breath, I'm going to represent my son in the best light possible and help as many people as I can along the way.
How's your daughter doing?
My daughter is now a mother. My grandson is 8 months. His middle name is Michael, of course, because it was going to be Michael, but his dad's middle name is also Michael, so we won. We lucked out with that one. But I feel that we're all doing a lot better now with the grandson, because honestly, I feel like he favors Michael, just a darker version. And I just feel like Michael sent him to help heal us. She's doing well. I would like to see her in therapy, but young people, you know, they don't really want to listen. She's 21. She'll be 22 soon. And actually, I was at a short documentary called The Front Row. And it's a documentary. It's 16 minutes long. And it tells young people about their choices. You can choose to have your parents sit in the front row of your graduation, your trial, or your funeral. Well, that year, 2014, I sat in the front row of my son's funeral, in the front row of my daughter's graduation, and in the front row of trial when these guys were arraigned. And it was hard. And it really brought everything home. And I don't know if people really understand that when you murder someone, they're gone. But the ones that are left behind and the broken pieces that are left behind, that is where the hurt comes in. You know, I'll never stop missing my son, loving my son. My daughter will never stop missing. I'm finding out a lot of secrets. Like when he was here, of course, she wouldn't tell the secrets. But now, little by little, there's little secrets coming out about brother-sister stuff. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You guys really, you know, little by little, she doesn't give me everything all at once, but it's still fun all in the same. But people don't understand the havoc they cause when they murder someone because you're angry in the moment. As Sharon said, time. Just breathe. Just walk around. Just meditate. You know, talk to someone. And you'll see that it really isn't that serious. We can all agree to disagree. We can agree that we don't like each other, but we don't have to kill each other. You know, everybody has a right to be here. My son had a right to be here. I think that the gentleman took the coward's way out, killing him in his sleep. He's bigger than both of them. I think they would have had a hard time fighting him. Mm-hmm. And I don't speak their names because they don't deserve it. I don't focus on the mass shooters because they don't deserve that publicity. The focus should be on the victims and the victims' families, and that's how I live my life. So I just want to do everything I can do to heal my city. You know, I understand there were mass shootings, but there are shootings very frequently in Rochester, and these are people I know, or I know people who know these people, and it hurts. So I need to heal my city before, you know, I can really concentrate on what's going on all over the nation, because I feel this personally here at home.
Mm-hmm. So. When it comes to your personal decisions about owning a gun, you do own a gun.
I do.
You have a concealed carry permit.
I do.
Was that decision informed by what happened with your family?
It actually wasn't. I've owned my gun for 10 years, 2009, 2010. And I just felt I had a couple of businesses aside from my job, and one of them was a cleaning business, and I'd go to people's houses. I don't know these people. You know what I mean? You call me and you say, hey, I need my house cleaned, and I show up at your house, and you could be a serial killer. I don't know. You know what I mean? So I just felt like, well, you know, my brother was like, well, maybe you should check into doing this, and, you know, it's going to take a little while. And my thing is about a gun permit, you don't ever have to buy a gun. You may want the ability to, in case these crazy laws change. I think everybody should have the ability to do so, but you don't ever have to buy a gun just because you have a permit. But me, myself, I do. I carry my gun everywhere. It's like a part of my clothing, except today. When I get dressed, put on my belt, I put on my gun, I get my stuff, and I leave the house. And it's concealed. Nobody ever knows. You know what I mean? Because I'm not out to hurt anybody. I just want to make sure I get home okay. You know, because, you know, you go to Walmart to pick up some eggs and there's some crazy guys in there, you know, and you don't know what's going to happen.
If you were in a situation like what happened over the weekend in El Paso and someone brought a gun into a Walmart and, you know, started attacking people, would you retaliate?
You know, that's a hard question. Because as I stated, I don't have training. I've been to the range and I've shot my gun. I would do what was safest for me and the people around me, because I could shoot off my gun and bring his attention to me and those around me, especially if I miss. You know what I mean? So now I've really put myself in harm's way when I could just go hide somewhere. So that would have to be something that in the spur of the moment, I would have to figure that out. You know, I'm not just going to say, oh, yes, I'd shoot him. And I don't know that. I could miss six times. How do I know? And then, you know, he shoots me because he's pissed off because I've been shooting at him. So I don't know. I really can't answer that. I would have to do whatever was best in that moment.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really thoughtful answer. And it makes me wonder, do you think most people have thought through that?
I don't know. I hope so. I hope that, especially gun owners, I hope they've thought that, you know, you're not Superman. Just because you have a gun, you know, it doesn't mean that your bullet is going to hit its target. Sometimes they don't, especially when you have no training. And even when you have training, you know, you just never know what may happen. Targets move. I would hope that they would really think before they ran into a situation. It's like if a building's on fire. If you're not a firefighter, maybe you should just call 911. You know, who knows? If there's time, there's time. But if there's not, then you end up being, you know, a casualty of that fire as well as whomever may be trapped.
If you were sitting across the table from someone, I mean, close to the situation, the conversation we're having now, where, you know, maybe the two or three people you were with said, I am strictly opposed to owning guns. I don't want them in public buildings. I don't want them in my home. I don't understand where you're coming from. I don't understand your perspective. How would you approach that conversation? Because if you don't mind me saying this, I think you sound like a very open-minded person and you're willing to listen to other sides of the conversation. I don't know if that's true of many people in our society today. We have conversations about that all the time on this program. So if you were in that situation and you were talking to someone who had a very closed mind, mm-hmm. a perspective very different from yours, how would you approach that?
You know what I would say to them? And that's okay. How you feel is absolutely okay. I respect it. And if the law says that I can't take my firearm into a certain place, I'll respect the law and I'll follow the law. I don't want to get arrested. I'll follow the law. But it's okay that your opinion is different than mine. That's one thing we need to really figure out. You don't have to argue. You don't have to argue about religion and politics and views. It's okay to have a different perspective. That's what makes us who we are. We're all individuals. I will say this, in my situation with my son and not really knowing what happened, why it happened, for several weeks, I didn't want to listen to what the streets were saying. I was waiting for the investigators and the police to do their jobs. I will say I was very paranoid because I kept, what were they looking for? What did they want? Was it my son they were after or was it the other people in the house? Everybody knows where Big Mike lives. Are they coming to my house? I slept 15 minutes in shifts, like mm-hmm. looking out my window, waiting for somebody to possibly pull up to my house. And I literally was ready. I was going to defend my home and my child with whatever. I was glad I had that gun because I didn't know what was coming, you know. And even after they were arrested, my thought process was that all of them? Is that it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, you just don't know someone's intentions for you. And I am going to protect my home. I will not be a victim. I am a survivor. And if someone comes, I'm going to defend my home and my family. I'm going to with everything I have. But it's okay to disagree with me. I respect it, you know.
Tony, thank you for sharing your story. I'm glad we can remember and talk about Mike and Michael.
Yeah.
And listeners, be sure to check out the M Squared Foundation for Peace and Social Change. Again, we'll link to that on our website.
Absolutely.
And you can find more information there and reach out to Tony directly.
Yeah, absolutely. I love to talk, as you can tell.
Undersheriff Brown, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I would love to just add something real quick. And, you know, you asked an interesting question. What would you do if you were there in the Walmart? And I think, you know, we teamed up with Paychex for an active shooter video that's they produced it and used it for training. And our SWAT commander was the one that did it. And it's on our website for how to respond to an active shooter. And, you know, would you run? Would you engage? And in the video, we talk about your body's not going to go where your mind hasn't already been. You know, it kind of goes back to that training. If you've never seen yourself addressing an active shooter, you're not gonna. And that's okay. If you're, but so your mind wants to be, then I'm gonna hide. Cause, and she mentioned she might hide. So we really, you know, I just wanted to say that we do have that video out there in case for, that anyone can access off our website. And, you know, if your mind hasn't gone there, then your body's not gonna, you're just not gonna think about it in that moment. So it was interesting when you asked her and then her response and just the training that we've had, that if you don't do that, so we always tell deputies, you know, you always have to be thinking, what are you going to do? You know, when I had somebody in FTO, I'd ask them, all right, so we are going to this job, and this happens. What are you going to do? Because you have to put your mind there already so that your body can follow when it happens. And so many times when deputies or officers get involved in incidents, their minds resort immediately to training. If you don't have that training, what do you resort to? So that's why training is so important and why you need to really try to be there first. Because you are now introducing your firearm into this situation, and is he going to shoot at me? And if I haven't thought of that, so when the police show up to an active shooter, right, that's what we want. We want their focus on us instead of the victims that are in wherever that may be. So we want that. We want the shooting to start coming towards us. And, you know, you can do studies, and there's countless studies for active shooters that once you put force on an active shooter, almost instantaneously they end, either with suicide or death by police, once they have force back on them because they like to target people that can't respond. So our goal is to try to get there as fast as we can and put force on them as fast as we can so that their focus shifts from everyone else. But it was just interesting listening to that and how we talk about it, mm-hmm. and how the fact that if you have a gun, you need this training. You need to be thinking about it and putting yourself in that mindset so that if something does happen and you're there, what are you going to do? You've thought about it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting, if I'm standing with my three-year-old, I'm not going to start shooting at an active shooter, my granddaughter. I'm a little old to have a three-year-old daughter, but my granddaughter. I'm not going to put her in that, so I'm going to have to figure out how do I separate myself from her. But you got to think about that ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting, your question, and then your response. Mm-hmm. If you have a gun, you really got to think about some of these things so that the first time that you're trying to think about it is not during an actual event. Right. So it was just a great question, a great way segment into that.
Sarah Dumreis is here, and I know you're leading a number of local efforts to try to ask a grocery chain to change their policy on concealed carry. And I want to hear a little bit about that, but very briefly, Under Sheriff Brown, since we're down to our last few minutes, what, if you can describe super quickly, what the concealed carry laws are in New York State? Because I did reach out to this grocery chain. They did not want to send a representative for the panel, but they did send me a statement, which I will read. So just so our listeners have a good sense of what the law says under Sheriff Brown.
So I'm really trying to pull up. So I brought the law just so I could have the answer on that. So there's a lot of places that you can carry concealed, all federal buildings, all federal property. You can't. City buildings, there's an ordinance against it that you can't carry a gun in a city building. So there's a lot of places that legally you can't. So if a grocery chain, for example, would say you can't carry inside their gun, it wouldn't be a matter of you're breaking the law. It'd be a matter of you're breaking their policy.
Correct, their personal policy.
Correct.
And we're talking about Wegmans. So, Sarah, let's talk about what you've been talking about with Wegmans.
So, sure. I got involved with Moms Demand Action, like many of our volunteers, after hearing about some of these mass shootings and that are all over the news. But being in the organization and hearing survivor stories from folks like Sharon and Tony, I was really able to learn sort of the daily toll of gun violence and where gun violence really comes from in our nation. And I've been able to hear stories of domestic violence and day-to-day accidental shootings and incidences. And so diving into the data, we know that there are things we know about how laws can help keep us safer. And a lot of the conversation has already gone around the fact that in New York State, in order to carry a concealed weapon, you do not need any live fire training. So when I'm a mom of two young boys, and I'm constantly thinking about my surroundings, and I know that there could be people concealed carrying weapons, around me. And I know I'm not going to be able to avoid all situations where guns are present, but it is my job as a mother to know the situation I'm in. And if I think about the place I've probably spent the most time with my boys outside of our home the last, 7 years, is probably Wegmans, right? We're there all the time. They're running around. And so I know that Wegmans has control over their policy of what the people in the store are doing. So it just made sense to me that more guns means more gun violence. And while a lot of people point to things like mass shootings as a reason to carry in a place like Wegmans, we know the majority of mass shootings in our country take place in private residences, are most likely linked to domestic violence. And we also know that during mass shooting scenarios, there's little likely that there'll be intervention from the public. It's generally a law enforcement officer who intervenes. So So I just started contacting Wegmans, and they'd responded to me too via email, saying that they look to the states follow state law.
I can read their statement that they sent us. They said, "The safety of our employees and customers is a top priority for us. We expect our customers to abide by the laws that govern the responsible carrying of firearms in each jurisdiction where we have a store. That's our position on all laws within each jurisdiction, not just this one. If a state or commonwealth determines that the open or concealed carry of firearms is a citizen's legal right, we do not believe it is our place to contradict that determination. Whether there should be a change in the law is best left in the hands of the legislature and voters."
Right. So I can see why Wegmans would use that as a statement. But they have control over their store policy, much like Target, who does not allow carry in their stores via policy. Starbucks does not allow carry in their stores. Costco, Whole Foods, we could go on and on. So as a mom, it is my responsibility to know where my children are safest. And in my opinion, my children are safest where there are fewer guns. And so that's not Wegmans. And so what I've tried to do is just use, and it's a place where I can avoid. I was there yesterday with my kids. But it's my job to then to choose not to shop there as often as I can. And I think, you know, when I just think about the behavior of my children and their surroundings, that's something that's important to me, is to know, is to know store policy.
What's the next step for you?
So I don't really know. I think to educate other volunteers and people in the community to be aware. So, like I said, I know that Wegmans allows concealed carry, but I'm still going to go there with my kids. But I'm aware that people might be concealed, might be carrying. And so I think, and this goes back to your question about safe storage, laws and policies are wonderful, but what we need to do is educate our volunteers and our citizens to be aware. And so I think it's a conversation that I can have with other people who are in my same situation. You're going to go to Wegmans with your kids. You're putting your kids in a scenario where the other shoppers are carrying weapons. Or you can take them to Trader Joe's. The store policy is other people aren't carrying weapons. So I can make that choice.
Yes, under
Sheriff. Just real quickly, you know, the state regulates parks and schools. Mm-hmm. I think if a store says you can't carry a gun here, like I think people still carry in Costco. Right?
Absolutely.
And Tony mentioned that she carries her gun every day, just no one knows. Right? I go out with my gun when I'm off duty. No one knows.
Right?
Right? Because I'm not using it unless, God forbid, I had to use it. So just no one knows. And I think that's really when a store bans you, because all they're going to say is you can't come back to that store. There's no legal. It's not like a school or the state park or somewhere mm-hmm. like that. So I just got to end, but I just want to say, it's just you want to be understanding
right.
what's really going on.
Yeah, we've run out of time, unfortunately, but we will continue these conversations. I'd like to thank all my guests, Sharon Sattler-LeBlanc, Tony Nelson, Sarah Dumreis, and Corey Brown. Thank you all for being here.
Thank
you. We'll continue these conversations. More Connections, next.